This is Editor's Picks from WAMU's Bluegrass Country in Washington, D.C. I'm Jared Walker. This week we're highlighting a recent in-studio session with the three curators of a new exhibit at the Baltimore Museum of Industry entitled Making Music, The Banjo in Baltimore and Beyond. Historians Greg Adams, Bob Winans, and Pete Ross joined host Rosemarie Nielsen to chat about the history of the banjo, from the shores of West Africa to the workshops of Baltimore in the 1840s and 1850s.
I'm so happy to be in the performance studio here at WAMU's Bluegrass Country. With me, I have an assortment of banjos that are being fielded by three very talented banjo players and makers. So let me start out by introducing these gentlemen. I've got Greg Adams.
Hello, good afternoon.
Bob Winans. And Pete Ross. And the reason we're having this little banjo extravaganza today is that there is a brand new exhibit at the Baltimore Museum of Industry, which is not surprisingly in Baltimore, Maryland. The exhibit opened up this week. There's just been huge excitement in the banjo community about this. And so I've asked these fellows to come and tell us all what is going on in Baltimore. Do you want to start, Greg?
Sure. Well, the name of the exhibit is called Making Music, The Banjo in Baltimore and Beyond. And it opened on April 1st. We had our curators event on April 2nd. And then the exhibit runs through October 18th.
For you out there, if you have the opportunity, you should get that onto your dance card. It's pretty soon. I'm in the process of making my arrangements now. What would you like to start with? Do you want to play some music for our...
Sure. We're going to start out with a tune from 1855. It's Theme and Variations on the Melody of Yankee Doodle.
Was just wonderful. Now, if you tuned in late, that was Greg Adams. Greg, can you tell us just briefly about the banjo itself?
Sure. Well, what I just played for you was a piece that comes out of the 1850s. This is essentially the first industrial version of the banjo in the history of the instrument, essentially the commercialization of an African-American instrument. And the technique that I used, a downstroke technique, comes out of early instruction books, which are also essentially the commercialization of an African-American playing technique.
It's the most listeners of the show will know that technique as claw hammer banjo. That right hand technique goes back to West Africa, came over with the instrument.
And I have my listeners know I'm a claw hammer banjo wannabe. And there was some very nice drop thumbing going on there, although we might not have called it drop thumbing back then.
Well, back then, when the banjo was being commercialized in these instruction books, they're playing in this technique. They called it banjo style because that's the way you played it. But over time, it was called stroke style, thimble style, or in the context of the time, also Negro style because of its distinct associations with African-American culture.
Well, now I've jumped ahead and had you play music, but let's just set the stage a little bit. And can you just encapsulate the exhibit for me?
Sure. The idea of the exhibit is to look at the banjo as a Maryland tradition since at least the late 1740s. And in order to do this, we have to be able to look at the complexities of banjo history. The reason that the banjo is in this region is because of slavery. It is being commercialized in Baltimore because of the phenomenon of blackface minstrelsy and because of the nature center of Baltimore and its location geographically, industry is a major factor in what allows it to become commercialized in that context.
And who were the main makers from the Baltimore area? Is that a fair question?
Sure. The first maker that we know of from Baltimore was a man named William E. Boucher, Jr. He came from Germany, somewhere in the southwestern part of Germany, as far as we know. Came here probably in the early 1840s, actually came after his father had already come here. His father was also in the music business and was a singer. But William Boucher, Jr. Got into the business and then set up his own shop and started manufacturing banjos. So whereas banjos before this time, before the minstrel show is catching on and making this kind of thing popular, if you had a banjo, it was something you made it yourself or it was a one-off that somebody made for you. Boucher is the first person we know who is commercially manufacturing banjos, and he's doing it in Baltimore. And he must have made an awful lot of them because we now know of still existing somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 Boucher banjos, which is way more than we know of for any other maker from that middle 19th century period. So he was important in popularizing the banjo because of what he's making for people who want to play it. And just to sort of jump ahead, there's another, and it, I'll back up a minute. There are a number of his banjos, Boucher banjos, in this exhibit. I think, what have we got, 14 in there now?
14 total, but 11 of them are
11
Bouchers.
Of them are Bouchers, but two of the others are also made by another Baltimore banjo maker, contemporary of Boucher, started a little later. His name was Levi Brown. And so there were many fewer of his. We only know of the two that are in the exhibit. But there were other people making banjos in Baltimore. Boucher entered banjos and drums and violins into an annual contest, I guess you'd call it, at the Maryland Institute for the Promotion of Mechanic Arts.
Oh, wonderful.
Which is now known as MICA, Maryland Institute College of Art, but that comes out of the original one. And once a year, they had a big fair where if you'd made something and you thought it was really good, you'd submit it to the fair and see whether you won a prize. And Boucher continually won prizes for his instruments, including the banjos. But there were at least 10 other people who periodically entered banjos in this exhibit. These are other people in Baltimore, but we know practically nothing about them. We've never seen banjos that survived from them.
I went many, many years of my adult life without really understanding how significant the banjo has been in not just American music history, but American history. And so if you out there and who are listening to this show haven't had a chance to delve into the banjo history, you really should. Because when I finally became a banjo player, first of all, and then I started to do my kind of background reading, my mind was blown that I had made it all the way through American musical education, for one thing, without knowing this. People of my vintage, we won't talk about what that is, but people of my vintage, you know, the banjo was kind of an oddity. It was, you know, it showed up on hillbilly type television shows, really, and not so much in the broader culture. But so if one of you would like to talk a little bit about how the banjo swept America in the minstrel age, I think that would be helpful.
We need to start earlier, but back to it.
Well, I'm going to say a couple things that's sort of, it's to your point, but it's sort of...
I'm going to identify, this is Pete Ross that you're hearing.
So, we'll talk about the exhibit, but it gets to your point, which is really one of the main points we try to make in the exhibit, we try to support sort of a thesis, is why did this happen in Maryland? You know, it's not, people don't quite expect it to have happened here, but it's really for a couple reasons. Number one, we have these early records of the banjo in Maryland because we had slavery here really early on the large tobacco plantations on the Eastern Shore and right around D.C. One of the earliest records of the banjo in Maryland is from P.G. County, not far from where we are right now. In fact, that's the first place where the banjo is called B-A-N-J-O, banjo. It's other names, other variations of that up to that point. The other reason is that we found while doing this research for the exhibit and, on Boucher, was that there was a large number of German immigrant instrument makers and music retailers on Baltimore Street in Baltimore, and they were immersed in an area where there were also a large number of theaters. So right shortly before Boucher begins producing banjos, there's a huge explosion of this pop music phenomena, the Blackface Minstrel Show, and the banjo had become a centerpiece for that. And I like to say this was big. The Minstrel Show was big in American culture, like that's like Elvis taking off or the Beatles landing, and it swept through our culture. Everybody's obsessed with it, but nobody's making banjos you can go out to a store and buy. Boucher is there where he has access to the African-American technology in Maryland, and he also has access and cannot miss this stage phenomena, pop culture phenomena at the same time.
I really am glad you made the Elvis analogy, because this was what I didn't know. Right. I just remember reading through some of the history books. It's a well-kept secret to many people.
Yeah,
right. And
today,
the big thing about banjo history is that many chapters of this history are essentially marginalized within our culture. And it's the reason it's marginalized is because this is really difficult material to talk about. It's much easier to reflect on how wonderful it is to get together with a group of people, make music. The sense of community is very powerful. But the power behind that community can be so much more strengthened if we understand where these trends and where these traditions came from. And those connections take us back to Africa.
Before we go on and talk more about the exhibit, would one of you like to play another short song?
Well, we're going to go into Africa right away.
Oh,
so
wonderful.
Greg will transport us to Africa right now.
I mean, so the history of the banjo is linked to the Americas, not just North America, not just the United States, but linked to the broader Americas within a nearly 400-year history. And something this significant, this much longevity, has something important to tell us. So if we're looking at West Africa as the home of the banjo tradition, West Africa is home to well over 60 culturally distinct plucked spike lute traditions. And the instrument that I have in my hand right now represents one of these traditions. This is the Jola Ekonting. It has, like the early banjo, as we've discovered and learned about with evidence from the Caribbean, as well as in colonial North America, we've got a gourd body that's covered, it's cut in half, it's covered with an animal hide sound table. In this case, it's a goat. We have a neck which runs the full length of the body, which we call in organological terms a full spike neck, but it's essentially cylindrical. This is a part of a papyrus sedge, and this instrument has three strings, a long string, a mid-length string, and a short string that's tied on the neck. And so as we're looking at what are the connections to what we know about the banjo's development in the Americas, the gourd drum-like body with this animal hide sound table, the idea of strings at different lengths, we're all familiar with the five-string banjo, that short thumb string, this is typical of West African pluck lute traditions. What makes the accounting very much desirable to members of the banjo community, you call yourself, you know, a clawhammer player, you will see the same fundamentals at work with the playing technique that I'm going to demonstrate for you.
Colombara maniaco tecorsan.
That was wonderful. That was, if you tuned in late, that was Greg Adams playing.
This particular song is called Ejilo, and I played it on the Ekonting. It is played by the Jola people from the Senegambian region of West Africa. And the big thing that I want to emphasize about this tradition is if we are going to make connections between West African traditions and what we see with the banjo's development, we have to learn about these traditions on their own terms. What are the histories of these traditions? And within those contexts, that's where we can start finding the parallels. We do not want to treat any West African tradition as if it is static and has been unchanged. West African music has incredible dynamics. cultural interchange is taking place all the time, and we can't forget that. So bringing it back to the banjo. So if these are the attributes that represent aspects of West African tradition, what we have here in the Americas with the early gourd banjo can be represented by Pete.
And Pete, may I ask you, is that one of your banjos?
Yeah, it's a banjo I made.
A banjo you made. It's very nice.
Thanks. Thanks. Play a little sure. Something and we'll talk about it?
Please.
Yeah.
So.
Very nice. And can I ask you how you have that tuned?
Okay, so that's one of the interesting things about this piece. So this piece was transcribed from Frank Converse, who became a famous banjo player in his own right, heard it when he was a boy in around 1850. And it's sort of our best transcription of an antebellum African-American player's performance. And he's described, this is a guy who played around Elmira, New York, and Converse described the guy as saying he'd play a bunch of songs, then he would say, let me throw this banjo out of tune. And he would raise the second string a half step. So everything's pitched lower at this point, but it's essentially double C tuning that we know from old time music. So I always thought that was really interesting. Now, when Converse went on to become a professional stage performer in minstrel shows, he never used that tuning again. So there was something that was already established with the tuning that we heard Yankee Doodle on earlier that became sort of a convention of the stage performance. And it's always suggested to me that this tuning being used by this black guy, this early suggests that there's a direct transmission between vernacular black playing and vernacular white playing that's unmediated by the stuff being played on the minstrel stage.
I happen to own a gourd banjo, but I don't play it as well as you. That's really, and one of the things that an amateur finds daunting about the gourd banjo is getting it in tune and keeping it in tune. I have to say,
well,
for
me, you know, but you got to fit the pegs right.
Yes, you do.
That's not your fault. Somebody else dropped the ball on that.
Well, we probably should explore how the banjo moved from what Greg displayed for you and described for you in the accounting to what Greg or what Pete has played. Pete has just played. He's played a gourd banjo, so it's got the same body that the African instrument has, a gourd that's been cut off, has an animal skin head on it. But rather than the long round stick neck of the akanting and other African instruments, what the gourd banjo has is a flat fingerboard. You could take just a flat plank and make a fingerboard out of it. It also has a peg head with pegs in it to tighten the strings, rather than just having strings tied off on the round neck as on the akanting and other African instruments.
Right.
So the question is, where and when did that transformation take place? It's on the step, it's a step on the way to what we're going to recognize as a modern banjo.
And it's still before industrialization.
Yes.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it happened in the Caribbean. We have references from the 17th century to instruments played by enslaved Africans who've been brought to the Caribbean basin, various places in the Caribbean. We have descriptions of some of them. We have illustrations of some of them. And what they are is a gourd banjo, similar in many ways to what Pete has just played. They're a melding of the African instrument and what these enslaved Africans who've been transported to the New World encounter when they see European instruments, which have flat fingerboards and peg heads
and tuning pegs.
So you have those two things coming together in the Caribbean, apparently before that happens anywhere else. So the gourd banjo has already sort of become the standard by the time we begin finding references to black banjo players in North America. And we can find lots of references to black banjo players in North America. Only going back, however, to 1736. The earliest one is from 1736 in New York City. And we have, between that point, 1736, go 100 years into the future, just before the minstrel show comes on the stage, to the 1830s. We have collected maybe 58 references to banjo playing in North America. Only one of those is about a white man playing the banjo. Joel Sweeney, not Sam. Sam's his brother. Joel Sweeney in Appomattox, Virginia. Other than that, all of those references are to enslaved Africans who are playing this instrument. And if you take those 58 references and you plot them on a map, more than half of them are closely clustered around the Chesapeake Bay region, which gives us another reason why Baltimore is the logical place for the first commercial manufacturing of banjos to happen, because there's already a longstanding and very dense tradition of banjo playing in the area.
Now, you're holding...
I am holding one of the banjos made by this man in Baltimore, William Boucher, Jr. This is of an early design. It's hard to say when it was made because he continued making various designs, but it could have been made as early as the 1840s. It was a design he was using at that point. And what he's done is he's making the banjo easier to build. I should have Pete tell the story, but I'll tell it anyway. It has a wooden rim, a frame rim, like modern banjos do, instead of a gourd body. So this, in a sense, becomes the final transformation to what we have come to recognize as a banjo, although we certainly should and could call the gourd banjo that Pete played, it's a banjo, too.
Really, let's say this. Of all the time that the banjo was in the New World, most of the time it was a gourd-bodied banjo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The wooden rim, that's a couple hundred years. The wooden rim, just to the late 1830s. That's the amendment. It should be called a banjo, is what I just played.
Yes.
And the rest of them are wooden rim banjos.
Ah, okay.
Couldn't agree more.
Well, one thing I will remind you out there that we will post pictures of these so you can see. But from here, I can see clearly that the fretboard is very much the same as on the gourd banjo.
Yeah, we should say the one I'm playing is not a strict historic reproduction.
I understand.
So I've made ones that are very strictly historic reproductions or recreations, and they're a little dicier to play.
One of which is in the exhibit up in
the
Baltimore, the Haitian
exhibit.
Bonza.
Yeah, uh-huh. I made a copy of a banjo that turned up in Paris that had been collected in Haiti in the 1830s, I think.
Well, let me break in here now to remind you all out there that you're listening to Old Time Jam on WAMU's Bluegrass Country. I'm here in the studio with the three co-curators of the new exhibit at the Baltimore Museum of Industry. I've got Greg Adams, I've got Bob Winans, and I've got Pete Ross here, and just a bevy of banjos. Is that the right word? It's
sure.
A murder of crows. I don't know what it is with banjos, but... So now can we move forward? Let's talk about the next stage of
Well, let me take my turn and play
please.
You a tune on what I'm holding here, just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, give the listeners a chance to hear what a Boucher banjo sounds like. And just to remind everyone out there, all of these instruments that we've been playing so far are fretless. Banjos don't acquire frets until... They don't commonly acquire frets, probably till the late 1870s or early 1880s. And I'm going to play a tune out of one of the early instruction books. It's called Old Joe. Thank you.
Nice. And now that banjo then was an industrial product?
Yes. Yeah.
And what things did Boucher add to the?
We can sort of itemize pretty easily what he did. The most obvious thing is he added the drum tensioning hardware that pulls the head tight. So suddenly the pot is looking less like what Greg started with, and it's looking more like a snare drum, basically. Before that, they were tacked on. We should say Boucher also sold drums with his name on them, and we have one on display in the exhibit. And aside from that, he's applied some European forms to the design. We've got something akin to a fiddle peg head is the peg head of this. It's also akin to, very similar to the peg heads on guitars made by Martin, another German emigre. And one thing that I think is interesting to point out, and I don't know if it's been pointed out anywhere outside of our exhibit, is so not usually when people talk about changing it to a wooden rim, they say, well, it makes it louder, you know, it's more, you can keep it at the proper tension more. But what I really think, now that I build both, I work for Kevin Enoch 3 days a week on old-time banjos, and the simplest old-time banjo is actually easier to make than a gourd banjo, basically because when you make a wooden rim banjo, you have the pot of the banjo is the same shape every time. You can cut that joint the same way, you can crank them out, and it'll always fit that radius. You cannot control the curves on a gourd. It's sort of whatever Mother Nature produces. So there's no way to really sort of speed through production with a gourd banjo the way you can with sort of what could very well have been a sort of a factory line process in Boucher's shop.
And those of us who love banjos, I mean, I've seen many pictures of modern banjo makers, and they'll have big stacks of pots.
Right.
Now, for you who out there who don't play the banjo, the pot is the big round thing at the bottom.
The drum part.
it does look like a snare drum, but boy, when you see a big stack of, you know, 30 or 40 pots there, my pulse quickens.
You've been listening to a recent in-studio session with the three curators of an exhibit at the Baltimore Museum of Industry entitled Making Music, the Banjo in Baltimore and Beyond. This is Editor's Picks from WAMU's Bluegrass Country in Washington, D.C. We'll be right back with more from historians Greg Adams, Bob Winans, and Pete Ross.